From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Whitmer's message to critics of her proposed 45-cent a gallon gas tax for road funding. Bring your ideas to raise another $2.5 billion a year.
Anyone who wants to put an alternative plan that gets to that investment on the table, I will work with. I'm interested in seeing what they have.
What does business-friendly mean in Michigan, especially when it comes to education?
If the opening question is, what education do you want for your kids? And what education do you want for the community's kids? When it's your kids, nobody answers meet the needs of local employers.
And John U. Bacon on that Michigan-Michigan State game.
I'm telling you right now, this is the best basketball rivalry in the country, and this is the golden era for that basketball rivalry.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 160 years ago this week, Frederick Douglass and John Brown met in Detroit to talk about their hopes for freeing slaves and ending slavery in America.
And the gentlemen did speak and meet several times, but they didn't necessarily agree on the tactic to end slavery in America.
Later this hour, we talk about the significance of that historic encounter. But first, last week, Governor Gretchen Whitmer presented her first budget proposal to the GOP-controlled legislature, and she's here with us now to talk about it. Governor Whitmer, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
So going back to your first weeks in the State House until your time ended in the State Senate on January 1st, 2015, you have seen Governors Engler, Governor Granholm, Governor Snyder all offering their budget plans, and you've been part of the budget process as a lawmaker. What's it like for you now being on the other side of that equation as governor?
Well, it's very different writing the budget as opposed to debating someone else's budget. We have an incredible amount of work that has to go into this. It's a $60 billion budget, but at the end of the day, it's really 10.7, which is what the general fund is. And we do really important things like, you know, fund the state police and oversee our drinking water and take care of our veterans with those dollars. And unfortunately, that number has not grown in 20 years while the cost of everything else has gone up. So we had to make some hard decisions putting this budget together, but I stand by my budget. I think it is a real solution to problems that have vexed us, and I know if we pass it the way I wrote it, we're going to improve everyone's lives in the state of Michigan.
And now you are really out selling the ideas of this budget to the public and to lawmakers, and I think it's fair to say the biggest attention jumped onto that proposed gasoline tax increase for road repair, 45 cents more on the gallon. There was a moment from the campaign during a debate when Bill Schuette said you were considering a 20-cent a gallon tax, and you called that ridiculous. So what did you learn once you got into office that makes you now feel that 45 cents a gallon is the best way to get that money we need for roads?
Well, listen, the problem that we're facing is we have $2.5 billion need when it comes to our infrastructure. That's an annual additional need to what we're doing. A road tax is not something I wanted to propose, but the fact of the matter is, you know, it's time for us to have a grown-up conversation. No one is going to come fix our windshields for free. If we don't get serious and stop the smoke and mirrors that has been the state budget, and we've got to start investing in ourselves for our families, our businesses, our state, and our future. And so while this is a problem 40 years in the making, stealing money from the general fund and the school aid fund have only meant that our schools are falling further behind, that we have too many communities that can't drink their water. Our skills gap is real and it's big. And so when we fund the roads the right way, we can solve all these problems. And that's what I did. It is an honest attempt to fix the problems that are vexing us as a state.
And you have said that you would like to change how road funds are distributed in our state, revisiting that law passed back in 1951, giving disproportionate funding to rural roads in counties with far less traffic, far less wear and tear than we see in urban centers and metro regions. Governor, what would you like to see happen to that formula dictating how road funding is handed out and which projects get prioritized?
Well, the solution that I put on the table actually ensures that every dollar goes to fixing the roads. It also puts it into a fund that it will be distributed based on which roads are in the worst condition and which are the most economically important to our state and to our people. When we prioritize this way, we're going to see that the worst roads and the most heavily trafficked parts of our state are the ones that are going to rise to the top of the priority list. We're going to do it in a way that the public can see what the plan is for 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, and how it's going to impact their lives directly. This is something I think that's been lacking. We've seen the shell game where money's moved around. This stops that, meaning that every dollar will actually go where it's supposed to go. And people will see that the pain that they're feeling at the pump is going to directly take down the dollars that they have to pay to fix their cars right now. And we'll all be better off for it. And I think this is a much better way of doing it, to ensure the dollars go where they're supposed to go and go where they're needed most.
Why not put the onus of paying to fix the roads on the businesses and those big trucks that are the hardest on our roadways?
Well, the diesel tax will be going up as well, and I recognize it's important that we limit truck weights, and that's something that I am going to continue to prioritize and work on. But the fact of the matter is I've got a legislature, we've got divided government, and they've signaled that the one thing they're interested in is perhaps user fees, and I think this is a legitimate way to do it because every dollar goes where it's supposed to go. I can't say that enough. There's a lot of distrust in the public in our legislature and in government because they don't spend money where they're supposed to, and this guarantees that it goes and it'll get the job done.
Senator Majority Leader Mike Shirkey was on this program, and he said he agrees with you. The state does need to increase revenue for roads, but that your plan to pay for the taxes, to quote him, lacks creativity. House Speaker Leek Chatfield calls your proposal for the 45 cents a gallon a non-starter. And you have said, hey, I'm open to other ideas that they might put forward to raise those billions for infrastructure. Have you heard any ideas that pique your interest?
I know that everyone from the Chamber of Commerce representing business to the experts who are overseeing the roads, so state employees, we all know that what the number is, $2.5 billion annually to fix the roads and get us on the trajectory where we get to 90% of our roads in good or fair condition by 2030. We can do this, but it will take that kind of an investment. Anyone who wants to put an alternative plan that gets to that investment on the table, I will work with. I'm interested in seeing what they have. But to say that you like the education spending in my budget, but you don't like how we raise revenue, is not an alternative. They have a duty to make sure that we solve this problem, and I will work with them to do that. But there's not been any viable alternative that I've seen yet that actually fixes the problem.
Governor Snyder, as we all know, had a really tough time getting just over $1 billion for roads, and we haven't seen, you know, as much physical and visual evidence of better roads since then. Some projects and some improvement, but as you know, we're still blowing out tires and damaging our cars on our crumbling roads. So if you got that 45 cent gas tax increase within that 18 months, how soon do you think drivers could reasonably expect improved roads?
Well, Cynthia, if you look at some of the slides that I used during my budget presentation, it shows that we are declining rapidly. Right now, we're at 78% of our roads at good or fair condition, where we should be at 90. In 2 years, if we don't substantially change this, we'll be at 65%. 1 year later, it falls to 60%. And so the precipitous decline is what we're going to immediately be able to curtail. That doesn't mean everything gets better immediately, but when we do this, in 10 years, our roads will be as good as any other state in the nation. We'll be able to draw investment here. We'll be able to get ahead because we won't be paying repair bills. And we'll have the sound infrastructure that the future of mobility depends on.
I want to switch over in the time that we have to something that you said last week at the MLive Citizen Roundtable, Governor Whitmer, your thoughts on the third grade reading law. You called it destructive. Why did you say that?
Well, I think that we've seen that this punitive mindset that if a child's not reading by the end of third grade is absolutely flies in the face of all the science around kids and literacy. Instead of penalizing kids who don't read by the end of third grade, wrapping them with the support they need so that they can read, and if they're not, giving them the summer support that they need. This is the way that we attack the literacy problem that's plaguing our state. We are last in the country when it comes to literacy outcomes for kids. Telling our kids they're not good enough and they're not successful is not going to fix the problem. What fixes the problem is tripling the number of literacy coaches, increasing the Per Pupil Foundation, making an investment in our kids' education unlike any we've seen in a generation. That's why I wrote the budget the way that I did. It attacks these issues that plague our education system and ensure every child has real opportunity potential is universal, but opportunity is not. And education is what levels the playing field. And we've been shortchanging our kids. And that's why we've got the outcomes that we have.
Do you, as governor, have any options to alter or get rid of a law that was adopted in 2016?
Well, I'm going to try to work with the legislature and the State Board of Education. We've got an opportunity to hire a new state superintendent and have some leadership on that front as well. And I think, you know, we've got to start that conversation. And so I am going to be sitting down with the legislative leaders this week, and it's one of the issues that I want to raise.
I'm sure you heard it when you were on the campaign trail. People, voters, they want to see action, not gridlock, not stalemate. As you've made now this transition from years in the legislature to being the governor of Michigan, how will that time you spent as a legislator serve you as you work with lawmakers to get a budget in on time?
Well, you know, I think we've got to build relationships. It's so difficult to negotiate, much less trust one another, if you don't know each other. And so we've been having our quadrant meetings. We meet every 2 weeks with the four leaders of the various caucuses, Republican and Democratic alike, and me and the lieutenant governor. And that hasn't been done since John Engler. But it's critical to have a conversation where you can focus on where you can find some common ground so we can get it done. And that's something I am absolutely committed to. I take every opportunity to acknowledge the leaders in the legislature and see the humanity in one another. And I think when we do that, we have a real opportunity to solve problems and show the world that divided government doesn't have to look like D.C. It can look like Michigan.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
As you heard, Governor Whitmer is not a fan of that Michigan law that would hold back third graders who cannot read at grade level, which is exactly what starts happening next school year. That's despite lingering questions on just how the decision will be made.
The law requires that students are retained if they are one or more grade levels behind. What we don't know is what does that mean in practice?
Checking in on the state's third grade reading retention law. That's tomorrow on Stateside. Coming up next, just what does business friendly mean in Michigan, especially when it comes to education, brain drain, and Michigan's workforce? We'll dig into that question after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
They seem to be business friendly.
Business friendly environment.
We have a much more business friendly administration.
Business friendly is, I don't know, I never thought about that.
Just what does that phrase, beloved by politicians, business friendly, really mean? We've been exploring that question on Stateside over the past few Mondays, from what it means to small businesses and big corporations to women and minorities in business. Well, now as we continue drilling down on this phrase, we'll look at what business-friendly means when it comes to education, brain drain, and the workforce of Michigan. Here now are representatives of two Michigan-based think tanks. Vincent Vernuccio is a senior fellow at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and Lou Glazer is president of Michigan Future. Thank you to both of you for being here today on Stateside.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Cindy, thank you for having us on.
Let's go to the voices of people who are part of Michigan's business community, because we asked them, what do they believe business-friendly means? Let's listen to what a Dearborn business owner says.
My name is Abe Saad. I am the owner of Dearborn Meat Market. My definition of business-friendly would be like our workforce. We hire people that have full experience and that know what they're doing. I believe hiring people with good education, good workforce, good background history is my type of business friendly.
And we've heard that view spoken on Stateside before, that we as Michigan need to attract and create an educated workforce. So how do we do that? Is there something Michigan should be doing but is not to make this educated workforce available to business? Lou, I'll start with you.
Well, first I would say when we think about education, it's really interesting in the conversations I've been involved in. The enormous difference in the conversation, if the opening question is, what education do you want for your kids And what education do you want for the community's kids? When it's your kids, nobody answers meet the needs of local employers. When it's about the community, a lot of the conversation is employer-based.
Why is that?
Well, who knows? Part of it very well might be that people think about other kids differently than they think about their own kids. So other people's kids is how can they meet my needs rather than what's best for the kids. So we've always started with the notion that you have to have an education system that does two things. One, that allows kids to create and pursue their own dreams, whether they're in Michigan or not. And secondly, all kids deserve an education that builds a set of foundation skills that are going to allow them to succeed in a 40-year career where none of us have any idea what jobs are going to be in 10 years, let alone 40 years.
Well, I would agree with that. And we have to remember that careers are no longer static. That
correct.
There's a lot of moving around, you know, especially you see now with the sharing economy, or they call it the gig economy. So things are changing. But what's really interesting is that 40-year career, that may not be for an employer. That may be for someone working on their own. And this goes back to that business-friendly environment where we want to make it as easy as possible for people to say, okay, I want to work for an employer. I want to have a traditional job, or looking to that next economy, the new economy, work for themselves, not saying this is what you have to do, but making it easier for those children to say, well, this is what I want to do, and this is what I want to do on my own, and build my own career doing my own job.
How much influence should business have in determining what gets taught in our schools and what our kids learn?
Yeah, I would say very little from my perspective. I just really think the odds are that fewer and fewer of us are going to work for an employer, and certainly not for any long period of time. So, and employers, and they should be, are very interested in what they need today. What employers need today is not that important to kids over the next 40 years.
And what's really interesting, though, is that a traditional four-year college education may not be for everyone. You have kids today coming out with massive, massive debt, shackled for their early adulthood with student loans that are incredibly difficult to pay back versus other people that are going into the trades. You know, I was able to go to the IBEW facility a few years ago, the electrical workers training facility outside Detroit. Saw their Earn While You Learn program, becoming apprentices and electricians. So we can't discount the trades and people going into that line of work, being able to come out with a job that pays very, very well and without being shackled with the massive debt that we see coming out of a four-year graduation rate.
Yeah, look, all kids should have an opportunity to explore all occupations and decide what they want to be. Here's the reality, though, a couple of things. First of all, most business leaders and political leaders who make that case, their own kids are getting four-year degrees. So the Fed just has done this amazing work. They do an annual survey on the economic well-being of households in America. And for the first time ever, they ask about your parents' education. If 21 to 29-year-olds in America, if you have one parent with a four-year degree, 71% of those kids get four-year degrees. 19% if both of your parents have a high school degree. So this once again is adults telling other people's parents to do something different with their kids than what they're doing with their own kids. Second, in the Fed survey, they do a very good job of analyzing debt in general and student loan in particular, and they find absolutely no data that there is this student debt crisis that everybody says that there is. Most people have debt, pay it off, and have higher incomes than if they didn't get a four-year degree.
I want to move on to another issue that has been certainly talked about a lot in Michigan, that so-called brain drain, where the workers, skilled and educated and trained workers, leave Michigan to pursue other opportunities in other states. We spoke with an economist and sought his thoughts on what it would take to make Michigan business friendly. Let's listen and talk about it on the other side.
So my name is Charles Ballard. I'm an economics professor at Michigan State University. The biggest problem that businesses in Michigan face right now is that they are having trouble finding the workers with the skills that they need to do the job that needs to be done. And what that suggests to me is that a business-friendly policy that would also be good for Michigan would be just a whole host of things along lines of K-12 education, apprenticeship programs, training programs, getting students into community college or into four-year, that would be business-friendly because it would give those businesses a greater supply of workers who actually can do the work. And it would be good for Michigan because it would make us a higher skill, higher income, higher wage state.
Vinny, is that what it would take, do you think, to keep more workers here?
Well, what we've seen across the country is another thing to add is a right-to-work law. We saw massive population since 2010, 3.4 million people moved from 9 right-to-work states to right-to-work states. So something like that, a right-to-work law that you would say is business-friendly, that is pro-worker, giving workers the freedom to choose whether or not to pay a union and still keep their jobs, increases employment, increases wages, and also increases population.
So the normal brain drain conversation is about recent college graduates, right, where they end up. Basically, where they end up is in big metropolitan areas. You know, the main places are New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, and whatnot. And when you ask them why they end up there, two-thirds of them say they decided on where they wanted to live first and then look for a job. So this notion of having vibrant central cities, you know, is enormously important. We've always had placemaking sort of at the top of our economic development agenda. I agree with Charlie that this is a human capital driven economy, and that's what matters most to employers. That's what Amazon basically said. And the state basically has not made that an economic priority and really should.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about what it means to be business friendly as we talk with Lou Glaser, president of Michigan Future, and Vinny Vernuccio, who's a senior fellow at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. So we're getting the views of two Michigan-based think tanks. I want to have you listen to a business owner from Ann Arbor and get some thoughts.
My name is Deborah Power, and I'm the president of Power Marketing Research in Ann Arbor. Business friendly does not mean things like incentives that don't really encourage growth. In other words, saying things like, you know, we'll offer Amazon all of these great incentives to come here, but it's all sort of a bit of puffery and a bit of, you know, that frosting on the cake. So, you know, business friendly is offering the transportation that people need. It's offering the employees that are well trained and encouraging them to grow locally and make local connections.
Deborah seems to be seeing like these business incentives in Michigan being offered to these big fish, these multi-billion dollar companies from elsewhere, and not enough going to where she thinks we need it most, the homegrown, local, smaller businesses. Lou, what do you want to say about that?
We have not been big fans of offering incentives to companies of any size. So, I mean, that stuff by and large has not worked. You know, and the Foxconn thing in Wisconsin's a good example of companies are going to end up doing what is in their best interest, irrespective of the incentives. We'd be better off without all that stuff.
Vinny, is that played out in Wisconsin where we just recently heard Foxconn saying, maybe not those blue-collar jobs that we said were coming to Wisconsin. We're going to do research and development. They're going to be white-collar jobs. Was that a bait and switch?
Well, Cindy, first, I have to start off with an apology. I know you wanted a debate between Lou and I, but when the previous caller started off with we shouldn't have incentives, we both looked at each other and started nodding in agreement. Incentives are not the right way to attract businesses. It's keeping it friendly across the board. Keep the environment good across the board. Don't pick winners and losers. Don't give special favors. And that's how you attract job creators.
I mean, we certainly agree on that mm-hmm. this incentive stuff is, at best, it's the icing on the cake. And what we need to focus on is the base of the cake, not the icing kind of thing. And we've been doing a horrible job at that. Where I think we would disagree is what's the most important part of the base. From our perspective, the most important part of the base is developing, retaining, and attracting human capital. That this is a human capital-driven economy. If your goal is the economic well-being of Michigan households, human capital is what matters most. But I believe it matters most to employers. So to us, that is more important than having the lowest taxes and the lowest regulation.
I wanted to listen to the co-owner of Detroit restaurant, Tekoya, kind of talking about politicians, you know, talking about making Michigan business friendly.
My name is Philip Kafka, and I was an entrepreneur in New York and then decided to start purchasing and developing real estate in Detroit back in 2012. I very rarely trust a politician who's an attorney. knows what it means to be business-friendly. So when politicians start to talk about how business-friendly they are, that's just something they're trying to say to get my vote. Business is the process of action and movement, and law is the process of putting barriers on that. Being a lawyer or being an investor doesn't qualify you as a business person at all. Those are two totally different things than being a business person.
So are politicians, our lawmakers, are they in touch with what business really needs?
Well, Cindy, I'm going to tell you exactly what government can do to spur business. Are you ready?
Silence.
Silence. I have a good friend, Wayne Cruz, at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He has a saying, you don't have to teach the grass to grow. You just have to get rid of the rocks. And I definitely agree with the caller. We don't need politicians picking those winners and losers, saying what is business friendly. It's removing barriers. Once again, going back to lowering that tax burden, reducing those regulations, letting job creators do what they do best, which is create jobs, and government getting out of the way.
Basically, the odds are overwhelming that we've got too much red tape, but I don't really think that that's as sort of important to a functioning, successful economy as people make it out to be. So, you know, I go back to Amazon again. Amazon basically decided in two places that offered them the least incentives, New York City, the most expensive place in the country, and suburban D.C., almost the most expensive place in the country, to put 50,000 new jobs. Google is expanding like crazy in Manhattan. All of these places increasingly are going to the places with the highest talent concentration, where talent is adults with four-year degrees. That is what matters most to economic well-being of both companies and households. To me, that's what economic success-friendly means and should mean.
We started out talking about business-friendly versus people-friendly, which certainly makes us want to kind of spend a bit of time here talking about issues such as minimum wage or sick days or health care, all very, very huge complex issues that we're not going to resolve in this conversation. But the question is, how do we pay for these? What role does or should business have in providing a wage you can live on, sick days so somebody doesn't have to come into work sick because they can't afford an unpaid day, or health coverage? What role should business have in that?
You know, the Michigan Future Board, this is the one place in which we are split. So the one thing that we all agree on is that you want people who work, particularly people who work full-time, to be able to support a family. And we're also all agreed that at the moment, the market's not taking care of that. It's like 40% of the jobs in Michigan pay less than $15 an hour. But the split is do you do that through things like the earned income tax credit and government provision of health care, or do you do it through employer mandates like minimum wage, sick leave kind of thing? That's where the split is. But from our perspective, you've got to do one or the other. You either have to have public programs that boost income for working families, or you have to have mandates or some combination.
Well, I mean, one of the best economic programs is a job. I mean,
at the end
of the day. And especially for those just starting out in the workforce, they need a job to get the experience, to get the work ethic that is going to serve them for the rest of their life. And unfortunately, when you see by government artificially inflating the minimum wage, and especially if it gets raised to $15 an hour, you are going to price people that need that first job out of the marketplace, and they're not going to be able to get on that first rung of the economic ladder. They're not going to be able to get that work ethic and that training, and that's going to harm them, you know, in some cases for the vast early part of their career.
So our new sort of economic agenda for the state basically reframes sort of Reagan, a job is the best social program, to a good paying job is the best social program, which we firmly believe. The problem is that even in the highly successful states, high per capita income, high median household income, there is a proportion that's not 40%, but is close to that. And because there's so many low-paid jobs in the economy kind of thing. So some conservatives have used the earned income tax credit as an alternative to the minimum wage kind of thing. We just think you got to do one or the other. If you simply say that we want the government not to do anything to augment low-wage work. And a lot of low-wage work now is done by people raising kids, not just by, you know, if it's just for college students, it's fine the way it is, but it's not just for college students. So if you don't, you're going to end up accepting the 40% Alice rate, which every time I present around the state, I don't care what people's politics are, they're horrified it's 40%.
Well, let's just talk about the poverty rate. I mean, things are going well in Michigan. I mean, the poverty rate in Michigan fell from 17% to 14.2%. I mean, right. Those are—
It's progress.
That's good right. progress.
But what of that 40%? What of that 40% who's left scrabbling to, as you say, make more money, to be able to put a wage together?
They absolutely need to be making more money. And the way they do that, having a job, getting experience, working their way up the economic ladder, that's the way to success. That's the way out of poverty. It's getting that experience. And I'm afraid that when you raise the minimum wage to artificial levels that destroy those first jobs, then you're taking that rung away and you're actually going to exacerbate the poverty problem. So compassion is letting people that are just getting into the workforce get a job, get experience, work their way up. And frankly, it's good for business.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but it's really been terrific picking both of your brains on this topic of what is business-friendly mean to Michigan. Lou Glaser from Michigan Future and Vincent Vernuccio, Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up next, we talk hoops with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubagen. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Whether your team won or lost tonight, give me the Michigan-Michigan State game on the last day of the regular season every year. Cannot think of a reason not to or why they haven't done it until now. That tweet came Saturday night from Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubagen after the big regular season finale between the Wolverines and the Spartans, which gave Michigan State a share of the Big Ten title. John, how would you describe the basketball rivalry between these two?
I'm going to tell you this right now, and do we get to North Carolina? If not, then I'm probably safe. It's the best basketball rivalry in the nation, if you take everything into account.
Why?
Because UNC had to claim they're not a university to keep their banners, that their no-show classes for 18 years actually count, which accreditation should look into. But that's what they had to say to the NCAA to keep their banners, because the NCAA does not want to get into whether this class counts or not counts. They don't have time for delving into all that, obviously. So UNC said, you're right, these are fraudulent classes, and we think they're okay. They're fine. So right there, sorry, UNC, and Roy Williams, the head coach, is on some car ad right now. I don't know how he can do this with a straight face. In the CBS poll last summer, 2018, that is, the coaches anonymously named John Beilein the most respected ethical coach in the country, and number six out of about 300 is Tom Izzo. I'm telling you right now, this is the best basketball rivalry in the country, and this is the golden era for that basketball rivalry.
You know, before that game Saturday, Tom Izzo declared this was his biggest game ever at the Breslin. What do you want to say about what each team gave on Saturday?
They gave whatever they had, and you could see it from the start. Look, the Breslin crowd, hats off, they were ready. A whiteout was a whiteout. It was a blinding whiteout. Everyone in white T-shirts, of course. One of the rare times, as my tweet pointed out, why is the Big Ten not scheduling this game as the last game of the season every single year? Michigan, Ohio State in football, of course. Purdue, Indiana does it in basketball and in football, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is a marquee matchup and should be getting more national attention. And for the first time ever, they were playing on the last day for the Big Ten title. They knew that whoever won was going to get half the title that day. And, of course, that banner went up pretty damn fast.
It sure did. You know, Michigan blew big leads in both losses to Michigan State. So why couldn't the Wolverines hold on to the leads? And what's up with all the foul trouble when they play Michigan State?
Not unrelated. The lead was 12, I think even 13 points at one point in the first half. The first half don't count for much, but that should count for something. That should be enough to hang on to. And then as the half dwindled down, the lead went down to 6 points. And foul trouble is a big part of it, huge part of the second half. Michigan State had 30 free throws to Michigan's 7. Now, if you want to get a Michigan fan around the bend, mention that stat. Why is that? Now, you could say that they're not quick enough, that they are, in fact, fouling that much. They're getting tired. They don't have a very deep bench, which means they only have two guys, maybe three, who can come off the bench and provide real playing time.
Looking at college basketball right now, where would you put Cassius Winston?
Tell you what, if he's not the Big Ten MVP this year, I demand a recount. I've seen enough.
It's amazing. He's not a big, tall guy, but he gets those floaters off over the big guys.
He's listed at 6'1", and I seriously doubt this.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's also funny, too. I recall meeting Isaiah Thomas for the first time. And oh, he's the cute little guy in the Bad Boys. No, he's 6'1".
But compared to some of
the cute little guy is 6'1". I don't think Cash Winston is 6'1". They always pump him up in the program. But he's playing very big, and he was clearly the key. They're missing two stars. Not just starters, but stars out of that game for Michigan State. I think this might have been Tom Izzo's best coaching performance. He should probably be the Big Ten coach of the year. He won't get it because the winners never do.
Okay. But that's you've always been a fan of what he does.
Of both these guys.
Both of them, yes.
And they actually have an immense amount of mutual respect between these two. I don't think the football coaches share that.
Looking ahead, Big Ten tournament next weekend, do you think we will see these two meet again, or will Purdue spoil the party?
If there is a God, we see them play again, because it'd be great TV, great drama. Look, both these teams are going to be, you know, near top seeds in the NCAA tournament. They've already got that secure. Right now, Michigan State is considered a 2 seed, Michigan a 3 seed. That's more than close enough to win a national title. So, man, do this thing one more time, please.
What about other Michigan teams for the NCAA tournament seeds, which will be announced on Sunday? What do you think for any other Michigan teams?
Not much chance.
Not much chance. So we're really focusing on Ann Arbor and East Lansing.
And rightly so.
And good time if you love college hoops.
If you don't, you have to listen to it all the time anyway, so you might as well get a bracket.
Hey, Pistons on fire. What do you want to say about our Pistons?
Not much. Does that sound horrible? Here's the beauty part, and this is my argument about college sports versus pro sports. Look, Michigan State and Michigan right now are having great seasons. They're both top 10 teams, hats off. And I don't care. You put them out there against the Pistons at their worst, and we've seen that recently, they'd crush them. It's not even close. All right, and yet they can barely fill the LCA for these games. They can't fill it. So my whole point about college sports is we don't watch for the prowess. We watch for the passion. It's the passion of college basketball that we're so attracted to.
And you're not seeing that as much when you look at the pros.
Look, I mean, God bless the Pistons. They're doing well, and they're going in the right direction. But I'd rather watch the Spartans or the Wolverines every day.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator John Eubacon. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
160 years ago this week, two of the towering figures in the abolition movement met in Detroit. March 12, 1859, John Brown and Frederick Douglass sat down together in Detroit to talk over their strategies for ending slavery. The University of Detroit Mercy School of Law is marking the historic anniversary with a symposium titled Detroit's Abolitionist Movement, 160 Years of Fighting for Justice. Nick Schreck is with us, Director of Clinical Programs at UDM Law. Welcome back, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
And Ken Coleman is with Michigan Advance, a Detroit history buff and author of On This Day, African American Life in Detroit. Hey, Ken, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
So, Ken, what brought John Brown and Frederick Douglass to Detroit on this March 9, 1859?
Well, it was interesting. Frederick Douglass was wrapping up about a 6-week tour through Big Ten states and talking about the importance of ending slavery. And so in about 6 weeks, Douglass gave about 50 speeches. And his last one, as we know it, was on March the 12th, 1859 in Detroit.
And then John Brown, who really was, he moved all over. He just tried to do a pin map of John Brown's location. What brought him up? Was it specifically to meet Douglass?
No, not specifically, but it was definitely on his mind. By that time, by 1859, John Brown was a Kansas resident. And an African-American from Missouri, a slave state, contacted Brown and wanted to have Brown assist him and several members of his family reach freedom. And Brown took the African-American gentleman up on that offer. And so what brought John Brown to Detroit in 1859 was obviously the last stage along the Underground Railroad. And with John Brown were about a dozen African-American slaves who had left Missouri who were looking for freedom. And so destiny brings Brown and Douglas together for that reason. But again, as I point out, the gentlemen had known each other, Brown and Douglas had known each other for about a dozen years, and Brown sees this as another opportunity, yet another opportunity to try to convince Frederick Douglas about this crazy idea he has about Harper's Ferry that would occur later that year.
Yes. Now, let's dig down into exactly what Brown's agenda was. What was his plan, and what did he want to get Frederick Douglass's imprimatur on?
Yeah. So he wanted to get the support. Brown wanted to get Douglass's endorsement, if you will, for this idea that he had around Harper's Ferry. And Harper's Ferry was an arsenal. And it had proximity to the South where slavery was still being carried out. And Brown has this idea, if he can recruit thousands of people to go along with him to overtake, commandeer Harper's Ferry, it could ultimately become the first stage, if not the military, the base, excuse me, could be the first stage in providing and creating this haven for freed slaves where they would push back against American slavery. And so in October of 1859, that's what happened at Harper's Ferry. But the meeting in Detroit at William Webb's home, an African-American abolitionist, that meeting on March the 12th, 1859, was another opportunity that John Brown had to try to convince Frederick Douglass that this was the way to go.
And Frederick Douglass's response was?
Not so much. Douglass clearly respected John Brown. In fact, if you go back to Frederick Douglass's North Star publication, as far back as 1848, Douglass writes about John Brown in very, very, very good terms. He called him one of the most interesting people that he had ever met. And the gentleman did speak and meet several times between 1848 and 1859, but they didn't necessarily agree on the tactic to end slavery in America.
Take us back to that 160 years ago. What did Detroit's abolitionist movement look like at the time?
You know, obviously the proximity of Detroit to Windsor, Ontario, and Canada made Detroit a very important stop. As it pointed out, really the last stop along the Underground Railroad. You know, in 1859, Detroit had a small but very, very, very interesting and powerful African-American community. The 1860 census says about 1,400 African-Americans lived in Detroit out of the city's 40,000 residents. So it was a small community, but a very influential community. You had people like William Lambert and George de Baptiste, African-Americans who were prominent in the abolition movement. But there were also whites who felt the same way. And the Anti-Slavery Society, a chapter, if you will, of the Anti-Slavery Society had been founded in Detroit as far back as 1837. And so you had whites and blacks who believed that slavery was wrong. Now, I often point out, and we've learned in recent years, that there were slaves, African slaves or black slaves in Michigan in the 1700s, but certainly by 1837 and certainly by 1859, when Brown and Douglass meet, it is a free zone for African Americans to live and prosper, and some of them moved on to Canada. Some of them lived in Detroit proper, but it was a very progressive, we would use the term progressive. It was a very progressive community as it relates to race, and at least on the issue of slavery.
Nick, where do we find the historical marker that commemorates that meeting that happened between Frederick Douglass and John Brown?
Yeah, so it's right on Congress and St. Antoine. There's a grassy area next to one of the Blue Cross buildings right in that area. And there's two markers, one noting the first synagogue in the city of Detroit, and then another noting that the location of William Webb's house was just a few hundred yards from that location. And that's actually where, you know, at least I had the idea when walking by that historical marker on the way to the law school for work. I said, wow, you know, you look at the date and you think, huh, that's coming up on an anniversary. And, you know, come to find out there had been a celebration in Detroit on the 150th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And so this is a nice sort of continuation of that. But yeah, just right there, you know, just a block in from Jefferson off St. Antoine and Congress.
just a few short months after John Brown and Frederick Douglass sat down together in Detroit, which was March 12, 1859. Well, on October 17, 1859, Brown led that fateful raid on Harper's Ferry in West Virginia, 7 months and a day, actually, after the Detroit meeting. And his men killed 4, wounded 9, and 10 of Brown's men were killed, including his 2 sons, 7 captured, including Brown. And then he was hanged on December 2nd in Virginia. Nick, you've unearthed your own family connection with John Brown?
Well, yeah. So my grandmother is a Brown. And so I always knew we had a connection, but I wasn't exactly sure where it was along the family tree. And so John Brown and I share a common ancestor. He would have been my 8th great grandfather. So a little bit further back in time here, but this Peter Brown of Connecticut would have been John Brown's, I think, second or third great grandfather. And so, we're distant cousins, but sort of neat history. And some of my Brown family that still lives in Pennsylvania, in the Erie County, Pennsylvania area, have much closer connections to John Brown. So it's been really neat to sort of unearth that. And when I was around the same time that I noticed the historical marker, I was also reading a book. Tony Horwitz, the guy that wrote Confederates in the Attic, and he also wrote a book called Midnight Rising about John Brown. And they mentioned this meeting. And so then I started doing a little bit more research and came across David Reynolds, who's going to be our keynote at the event tomorrow, who wrote a book that I think really went a long way to try and sort of rehabilitate the image of John Brown in a lot of people's minds, because he was, viewed by many as a terrorist,
That's what they would have called him today.
Absolutely. Today, you're right. Yeah, looking back. And so Professor Reynolds, he really went back and looked at, looking at the context, what was going on at the time, and really, John Brown, who felt, this biblical conviction that slavery was a state of war against African Americans. And so in his mind, what he did in Harper's Ferry was just a part of the battle in that ongoing war. And so, I think we'll hear a little bit more about some of that context, about, what brought these men to this meeting, what they were hoping to achieve. And that tension that, as Ken mentioned, you had this sort of different goals, different ways of trying to achieve the ultimate abolition of slavery that both Brown and Douglass brought to that meeting.
And Ken, when you think of the impact of that Harper's Ferry raid and Brown's execution, what was that deflection point in history? Where did it lead us?
Well, certainly I think that Brown's efforts, particularly at Harper's Ferry, really sort of helped to crystallize the real internal battle that America was facing, and led to, I think, I would certainly make the argument, the Civil War. And the major issues, one of the major issues obviously around the Civil War was slavery.
Yes,
from an economic standpoint, from a social standpoint. And so that was really, I look at Harper's Ferry as a touchstone moment that ultimately led to, what would become a couple years later, the start of the Civil War.
And there was very real panic in the South at that time that, Brown's idea that this actually would spread, that you would have additional uprisings in other communities. And so that really started, I think, fanning the flames of division that we're already seeing in this country.
Indeed.
And you had a lot of, the luminaries, the really big thinkers of the day, the Thoreaus, that were coming out and talking about John Brown, turning him into this hero and this someone that the song John Brown's Body that became, a key, Union marching tune to help kind of rally that spirit towards, fighting the South and slavery. So, really, I think it is a definite touchstone moment and something that, looking back and from today's perspective, it's hard to realize what people were thinking in the South, and you had this idea of like, oh my gosh, what if
all we're gonna these get people, invaded,
right? Exactly, yes. Or all these people that were holding in bondage in our communities, if they revolt, what would happen? And you had this is on the heels of Nat Turner and some other very high profile incidents.
And Brown is a white man. Let's be clear,
right.
That created shockwaves,
right.
particularly in the South. That if a white guy is willing to do this, so it definitely touched on.
Well, it should be a fascinating symposium, and it is free and open to the public from 9 till 12:30 tomorrow, right there at the main branch of the Detroit Public Library. And all they ask is that you RSVP by going to the University of Detroit Law School website, law.udmercy.edu. And we've enjoyed talking with UDM law professor Nick Schreck and Ken Coleman, Detroit history buff and journalist with the Michigan Advance. Thank you so much to both of you for taking us back 160 years to this very historic meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scond. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Razi Joffrey, Laura Weber-Davis, and Adam Reyes. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.